I didn't know that it was a crime to write a good book, which turned out to be a bestseller. And my view has always been that we need a progressive tax system which demands that the wealthiest people in this country finally start paying their fair share of taxes. If I make a lot of money, you make a lot of money, that is what I believe. So again, I don't apologize for writing a book that was number 3 on the New York Times bestseller, translated into 5 or 6 languages, and that's that.
That was the Democratic Socialist Senator, presidential candidate, and 3-house-owning millionaire Bernie Sanders responding to widespread mirth about his wealth while reiterating his usual complaint that the American tax system is not progressive and taxy enough. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special Tax Day, April 15th edition of The Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my compliant, presumably compliant, colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Taxation is Theft Day, my comrades.
Yay!
Hey, Matt.
Happy Tax Day.
Peter, I want to start with you. There's been a lot of foo-farah over the tax refund season and how much people are getting and such. Elizabeth Nolan Brown, our colleague, had a nice post about the perceptions of the results of the tax reform bill versus the realities of it. Everyone's always confused about taxes in general because complicated. So maybe let's start with that aspect. Republicans have been talking for 1,000 years, more or less, about how we're just going to get the taxes to fit on the postcard. That's my idea. Taxes on the postcard. We didn't do our taxes on the postcard this time around. Peter, why is that?
It's because taxes are complicated by nature, because people want them to be complicated. If we had very
simple,
everybody wants
speak for yourself.
Because
speak
almost everybody actually wants them to be very complicated, because what makes taxes complicated are all the carve outs and deductions, all the things that get you if you have special circumstances, like owning a house, like having a lot of income that you can deduct because it's part of your business operations for whatever reason. All of these things are what make taxes complicated. And whenever anybody says, well, we should simplify the system and get rid of all of these tax deductions, anybody who benefits from those tax deductions, and in particular people who benefit professionally because it's part of their businesses, their careers, their jobs, whatever, those people fight to keep those deductions in place. And what that means is that taxes are kind of inherently complicated, that they can't be simple. And until we all sort of collectively decide that each of us is going to give up all of the deductions and carve outs and sort of special things that that lots of people get and lots of people take, then taxes are not going to be filed on a postcard.
Bernie Sanders' main complaint, the United States actually has an incredibly progressive tax system, and the wealthy do pay far more as a percentage of tax revenue than they do in Europe. And actually, even poor people do. A 2017 article I was looking and preparing for this in The Economist, and this was before the Republican tax bill, which actually counters a bunch of things that Peter just said, where a bunch of benefits were foregone, carve-outs and things
like
that.
Sure, they did get rid of some of them, but they're still quite complicated.
Yeah, of course. According to The Economist in 2017, a single mother with 2 children in Sweden would be paying 34% of her total income in taxes. The equivalent in America is 13%. And that includes state and local taxes. So one of the things that really find a cup and chaps at my hide when Sanders starts talking about progressive taxes is he's pushing a narrative which is simply wrong. And it's not a little bit wrong. It is fundamentally wrong. And it means that we can't actually have a conversation about simplifying taxes. And I agree with you, Peter, that it's, you know, the postcard thing is stupid. And of course, now we live in an age where we'll get it on a postcard and then nobody will know where do you buy postcards or stamps or anything like that. But
millennials won't file their taxes.
It is so freaking wrong. And it's of a piece with these other grand narratives that people tell all the time about income, you know, income growth and benefits only go to the top 1%. The kids can't afford college anymore. All of this stuff. It's very disturbing to me on a Monday morning.
Catherine, you're an anarchist. We're just having a laugh at our shitty
segues.
Question segue.
Pre-show banter.
Banter. Is taxation theft at long last, Catherine? And if so, is Milton Friedman an accomplice, and should we try him at one of those mock trials at Freedom Fest?
Yes, this is, I would say, my absolute worst of my libertarian actualies. And believe me, there are a lot of them. But my absolute most annoying one is that whenever anyone expresses happiness about getting a tax refund, I cannot not give that speech. And the speech goes like this. Oh, really? That's great. I guess you just gave a tax you just gave an interest-free loan to the federal government all year. I hope that makes you happy. Like, I get it. I'm the worst. People are just happy to get a check. But it really is Milton Friedman's fault. Like, I think, like, we can accept, like, thank you for getting rid of the draft, Uncle Milty. We really appreciate it. At the same time, withholding, which was a well-intentioned effort to improve the efficiency of the IRS, has instead made people deaf and blind to the robbery that is occurring under their very noses every day. It just disappears from their paycheck. They never even see it. And then, insult upon injury, they are actually grateful. They pathetically grovel before the state when they get their refund at the end of the year. I hate it. I hate it. It makes me so mad.
And it's also, it seems that I mean, on balance, from what I understand, the tax refunds that people are receiving are smaller. It's just the refunds. It's just their overall level of taxation.
Which is good.
Is that also smaller. It so overwhelms our perception of our relationship to the IRS in a given year. It's just size of refund. We don't think in
That's
terms
right.
of size of tax burden.
But again, there's something more complicated going on here, because the story that Liz cited from the New York Times, they did a survey of various people, and they found that about 40% of people thought under this is the first year of the new tax law, that 40% thought they got a cut when in fact it was like 65%. So we're already overestimating, what we're doing or getting refunds and stuff like that. And again, I agree, it's confusing and annoying.
What is confusing people, Nick, is what Matt was saying, which is that after the tax law, people are paying less overall in taxes. However, they're getting smaller refunds. The reason they're getting smaller refunds is that the withholding has changed. And so, again, their overall tax burden for the majority of people, it's a 60-some percent of people,
has gone down.
However, because of the withholding changed, in many cases, you're seeing smaller tax refunds. And so
that same article concludes that the main reason people think taxes went up, or that they are paying a higher tax rate, is because liberal economists in the media sold that narrative.
There's also, by the way, a horrible logic to this, which is that luckily people control their own level of withholding a fair amount. So, you know, there are default behaviors, but you can choose how much is withheld from your paycheck. You choose that when you start a new job, for instance, and fill out a W-9. But the horrible logic of this public opinion situation is that if the government could mandate that people over withhold, or if it could nudge people to over withhold in the future, it should. That would make people feel more positive about the government at tax day. And I think that that's something that we should keep an eye on, keep a watch out for in the future.
Having said all of this, I think it is worth, on this most holy of secular holidays in the collectivist superstate, which I am somehow accused of supporting. If you critique Steve Bannon ever, then that means you're a rootless globalist who wants a single world government that taxes everything at 125%. But that escalated quickly. it's been sticking in the back of my throat. But I think I know some of those people. Kind of interesting is the fact that, you know, we did limit the amount of state and local tax deductions that can be done. And you are seeing in places like New York, where Matt and I live, like Connecticut, New Jersey, California, a massive decline in tax revenue, because people, high income people, wealthy people are leaving those states for states with better tax codes. And that, you know, to go to Peter's point about, you know, not about simplification or anything, but about carve-outs, some of these things have been getting screwed down a little bit, and that's all good. I think it'll be clarifying.
There's a piece about a week ago that came out about early analysis of H&R Block's refunds and tax season data. And it was interesting to note there that the 10 states in which people's refunds, not overall tax burden, but just size of refunds, were increasing the most, all red states. The 10 states where their refunds are decreasing the most, all blue states, which goes to Nick's point here. And also, I think, suggests that whatever political kind of fallout comes from this, it won't, it's a wash. My prediction is that it doesn't make that big of a difference here. Go on, Peter.
So I actually want to go back to Nick talking about the salt thing, because that's pretty interesting, especially in the context of the 2020 race and specifically Bernie Sanders. So if you look at the Bernie Sanders agenda, it's absurdly expensive, right? I mean, just the Medicare for All portion of it is $32 trillion, which would require basically a doubling of all business and individual taxes every year to raise that amount of new revenue for the federal government. And Bernie Sanders's response is always starts with, well, we should be taxing really rich people, right? Like millionaires and billionaires. Bernie Sanders, of course, we know is a millionaire, which is great, actually. And the money should come out of super rich people. So what does the SALT deduction do? Basically, it benefits really rich people in coastal states. It's a little more complicated than that, but those are the people, that's the class that gets the biggest benefit out of it. And who is attempting to repeal the Republicans' limits on the SALT deduction is a bunch of blue state, not entirely Democrats, but many Democrats, including New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, including folks like Anita Lowey, Democratic chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Democratic legislators from big blue states are saying you can't raise taxes on our rich people. How in the world are they going to pay for all of the, for the Bernie Sanders, even the Kamala Harris, which in theory is sort of less aggressive than the Bernie Sanders agenda, but it's still like she signed under the Green New Deal and Medicare for All and all of this stuff. Like, how in the world do they think they're going to do that if there is this kind of political resistance just to limiting the SALT deduction in New York State?
Fun fact. So the 13 richest congressional districts in the country and 41 out of the top 50 are now represented by Democrats.
Yep.
The presidential voting preference among the top 4% of wealth earners flipped to the Democratic aisle in 2012, and it looks like it's going to be there for that time going forward. Catherine, do you think Democrats are a little bit in denial about how they're all like the party of the rich?
I think they've been in denial for a long time about where the rich fit into their coalition. And this is something that we've talked about before. This idea that the Democratic Party is now made up of very rich, fancy schmancy coastal elites and also basically all the black people. And that is not a scientific description of the coalition, but there used to be a part in the middle, which was working class white people. And those people have largely abandoned the Democratic Party in favor of Donald Trump's Republican Party, at least maybe the Republican Party permanently, unclear. And the hollowing out of the Democratic coalition creates a lot of weird tensions. And that's why you get Bernie Sanders trying to walk this line where he says, you know, I'm a millionaire, you're welcome to tax me at a very high rate. But in fact, his party has very, very strong incentives and will continue to have very strong incentives to oppose actual taxation at a much higher level on the rich.
There's been ongoing news related to presidential candidates and presidential presidents, or even not presidential presidents.
I was going to say, that's generous.
Releasing their tax returns. So I think Bernie is releasing 10 years. Kamala Harris released 15 years worth of tax returns.
Which means, you know, the 16th year, that's the real doozy.
Yeah,
she's just faking us out.
Trump continues to drag his feet on releasing tax returns and says all kinds of crazy nonsense about being under audit or not being under audit and whatnot. Nick, on a basic kind of gut check level, is it your view that anyone running for president should be expected to cough up a big chunk of their tax returns because they are powerful people who seek power. And that overwhelms the perhaps libertarian privacy objection, saying, hey, look, you know, this is pretty sensitive data that the government is forcing upon you. Where do you stand in that great debate that I just invented?
It is such a great debate, Matt. It's probably the greatest debate of our lifetime. And
coming
soon
to a Soho forum near you.
I don't really care. I'm interested in Trump's taxes and how he did stuff. But in the end, I don't really care. I don't really care about Bernie Sanders. I care much more about the way taxes are structured and levied on, you know, on me than on, you know, some presidential candidate. And I do think it's, you know, when I don't think there should be laws mandating, the release of taxes or anything like that. And I think people sort it out. They weigh it. How important is it to know Donald Trump's tax liabilities over 10 years versus what he says he's going to do or what he's done in office? It's a sweet, you know, all of these candidates offer up a bundle of, you know, pluses and minuses, and people sort them out. And I think the tax issue is just one of those.
I also think that there's a place here to just say, actually, our status quo isn't bad on this, right? Like, we should not, I think, forcing people as a matter of law to release these taxes would not be useful. I also think a massive amount of ongoing public shaming when there is a belief that candidates are trying to hide something is appropriate. And I don't mind saying, like, socially, we offer less privacy to people who seek higher office. Legally, we offer them the same privacy. In my view, we should, at least. But socially and civically, yeah, let's just go after them.
Peter, earlier in this never-ending election cycle, you used the phrase low-tax socialist to describe at least some of the candidates, for instance, Elizabeth Warren. We've seen more time pass, more policies unveiled. In your snapshot of where the Democratic Party presidential field is at, are we still talking about low-tax socialism, or are some of these projects now starting to include higher tax schemes a la Bernie?
Well, taxes are part of this for certain. Nobody is talking. None of the Democratic candidates are saying, I don't want to raise taxes ever on anybody. What they're saying is we can do it's a kind of a dodge. They say, well, you know, of course we need to raise taxes on big corporations that aren't paying taxes and on very wealthy people. But if you look at the amount of money that you could raise from very wealthy people, first of all, the top 1%, and in particular the top 0.1%, are already paying a huge, huge portion of the total national taxes. Billionaires pay a lot of money in taxes. And trying to squeeze even more money out of them. I'm not saying that it's not possible at all as a matter of kind of tax math to squeeze any more dollars out of them, but you're not going to get the kind of money that you need to fund a Bernie Sanders style agenda, period. And in addition, there is a, as I said, huge political problem. You can look at the SALT deduction and the reaction from relatively well-off blue state people there. But I would also just go back a few years to the Obama era when President Obama said that he wanted to give limit or get rid of the tax deduction for college savings plans, the 529 plans. And those plans, who do they benefit? They benefit a lot of middle and especially upper middle class families who have been saving money for their kids' college. And the reaction against that from the left and the right, from Democrats and Republicans, was just instantaneous. No way. And the Obama administration pretty much immediately dropped it. If you can't raise just a little bit of money through SALT, and they did get that through, but again, there's a lot of reaction from there's a lot of pushback already. If you can't pass something like the 529 thing, then the politics of raising taxes on the upper middle class, on the middle class, where the money is, and where if you go to the kind of Nordic model countries that where you see Bernie Sanders style policies in place, they end up having 50% and 60% tax rates marginal tax rates on people, you know, making on income of over $50,000 or $60,000 on very middle class incomes. And so if you can't do that, then politically, the chances of raising money to pay for that kind of agenda is, I think it's not there.
You know, but Peter, and you've written, I think, eloquently and often about this, and this is part of the problem with the Republican tax plan that, you know, we're all suffering under now, is that there has been an almost complete delinking of revenue and outlays. And as a result, you know, Sanders has always been like, I don't know. He doesn't even talk about how he's going to pay for it with any specificity or the price tag. Other people say, oh, well, you know, we'll charge 70% on people making over $10 million, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, they don't have to, because the Republicans were never serious about paying for their wars and for their, you know, entitlements to, you know, prescription drugs and all of that kind of stuff for old people. And now we, you know, almost as if we're desperate and, you know, we conjure up a theory like modern monetary theory to say, like, oh, you know what, actually, maybe you don't actually have to raise taxes. You can just print more money until something bigger and worse happens. So, you know, this is... I think the Democrats are making a big bet that, like, they don't really have to come up with a credible way for paying for any of this. And I think where they're wrong is that Trump is actually, he's going to hammer exactly this. I think he was the reason why the Republicans were able to push through a limitation on state and local tax deductions. And he knows exactly what he's doing, because the main reason he's not releasing his taxes is because, you know, that guy has squeezed every freaking break out of the tax code possible. And that's probably why he doesn't want to release it.
I would just add that my prediction, based on the kind of pathologies that both Nick and Peter have just laid out, is that the likeliest tax increase when the next Democrat wins the White House in 2020 or beyond, will be the lifting of the cap on Social Security payroll taxes. The most directly tethered to an existing program, literally, and it's a much easier political sell. And I think you're going to see that on basically everybody's programs as they go forward. And I think it would be passed pretty quickly.
I think that's right. But I would still say that even if you do that, you can maybe start to plug the gap in Social Security funding, the shortfall there. But it's not even close to enough to kind of to pay for a Green New Deal, Medicare for all, free college for everyone kind of agenda.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and in theory, it's not.
It's probably it is probably the biggest pot of money that's left in the American tax code, but you can use it once. Right. And this is a thing that, like, Democrats will say, well, we could raise that. And they'll, you know, OK, how are you going to pay for Medicare for all? And they'll get asked that, and they'll say, well, we can, you know, we can start by by lifting the cap on Social Security taxes. And then, like, 2 weeks later, you'll be like, well, how are you going to pay for free college? They'll be like, well, we can start by raising it. And right. They spend this money like over and over again on the campaign trail because they don't actually have to develop a comprehensive plan. And the thing is, once you're in office, you can do that exactly one time, and then that money is gone. And then where are you going to go from that? Are you going to pass a VAT? Are you going to install 60% marginal tax rates on people who make $45,000 or $50,000 or $70,000 a year? Or is that going to be your plan? Because that's if they want to pay for it. If they actually want to pass these things with any kind of anything close to the pay fors that are necessary, that's what they're going to need to do.
This, by the way, is how people who are bad at budgeting also think about their personal money, which I think is one reason that politicians have gotten away with it. Like, for instance, people say, "Oh, I'm getting a tax refund. I'm going to use it to pay for that phone bill that's overdue. I'm also going to use it to pay down my credit card debt. I'm also going to use it to buy a nice new thing." I don't know why I couldn't think of an object I would want to buy. A nice new coffee table.
And really good speakers.
Yeah, Peter. But yeah, like this idea of sort of like windfall money, which is what people perceive tax increases to be in the process of federal budgeting, often get spent multiple times in bad household budgeting, and it will be spent multiple times in bad nation budgeting too.
I would, before we leave the tax subject and move on, I would, my ankle bracelet would start giving me electrical shocks if I did not mention the odious Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, otherwise known as FATCA, because everyone in Congress is terrible and should be flogged. that was passed in 2010, and it's been steadily imposed, gradually imposed now. It is this proctology exam that the IRS subjects all Americans who have any kind of account of anything overseas, in which the IRS then deputizes all foreign financial institutions to either cough up all their data on Americans or face huge sanctions or have to collect the tax on said Americans. And so what happens is if you are one of the 6 to 8 million Americans who live abroad, you can't get a bank account in your country anymore because they don't want to deal with the IRS. It's a nightmare. It's led to record levels of Americans renouncing their citizenship. Bad. And I just want to say to those out there who are listening and are thinking to go the full JD to Chile here and renounce their American citizenship once and for all, because screw it, I don't want to subject myself to such scrutiny. It's actually that the compliance is really difficult. Well, Congress has also increased the exit fee to turn in your passport to $2,350, in addition to which is the highest in the world, like by far. And you also have to prove that you've been in compliance with the IRS for the previous 5 years. And it's a big headache. So if you think you're just going to turn in your passport and all as well and become a Swiss citizen or a citizen of Bahrain or whatever, it's actually pretty difficult. And this was your public service announcement from Taxi Matt. Another weak news this week might well be the Mueller report. Finally, the long-awaited Mueller report might drop this week. I think the biggest surprise was that it didn't drop while Reason's website was being overhauled over the weekend. So good job making sure that didn't happen.
Or Catherine. While all of Washington was watching Game of Thrones.
Honestly, that was my second guess. I was like, 9 p.m. Sunday night would be ideal. Like, that's the new black hole to drop news
into. It can never beat John King being drunk talking about Osama bin Laden during the White House correspondence dinner.
Incredible.
If you haven't seen that on YouTube,
it's really incredible.
It is still the best. And mad respect for John King for bringing professionalism and trying to do it when he wasn't necessarily in a position to do it. But anyways, this might happen this week. Last week's news over or like controversies over the Mueller report had to do with Attorney General William Barr. William, right? That's his name. Using the word spying to talk about the surveillance that was happening on
he
Trump
was really out of line there, Matt. Really,
I mean,
out of line.
Am I crazy, Nick? Am I taking crazy pills?
I think you might not be taking enough, but yeah.
That this was actually like a very serious debate and people were shaking their damn heads like, I can't believe he said spying to describe surveillance. What's wrong with this person? And then the other thing that was being chewed over was his comments that, yeah, we should investigate to see whether the basis for the initial counterterrorism investigation and the FISA court documents and things like that. We just want to make sure that those are okay. We should investigate the investigators here. People are like, oh my God, it's terrible. Is this all kind of a precursor? Do you think, Nick, that our long national nightmare will in fact not end on this? That
clearly not.
Yeah.
Sorry. I mean, yeah, this is the conversation we're going to be having for at least 2 more years or maybe, six more years. I don't know. It's kind of appalling. And Barr, though, is not helping anybody's case obviously surveillance and spying, what's the difference? He was forestalling answering any questions, but he's a horrible presence as well. This is what you get when you get everything is super partisan and people don't really care about anything other than momentary success or defeat in a particular battle of a particular news cycle. It's really appalling, and it's only generally speaking going to get worse. But I also find it odd that people, the continuing love for the law enforcement and kind of surveillance state on the part of liberal Democrats is kind of, really getting to me because they used to be kind of good about that.
Catherine, per that, is there some value to be had of subjecting the kind of basis of the investigation to this kind of scrutiny. Because one of the things that you would see theoretically in that is maybe we'll peel back some of the curtain on the FISA court, which we've been asking for a really long time, you know, and this came out during the Snowden reveals back in 2013 that the FISA court, you know, is kind of a rubber stamping mechanism, or at least in terms of the responses from which judges, the rate that they approve whatever is asked to them. Wouldn't that be a useful exercise to kind of investigate the investigation to see how easy it is or is not to kind of have people, you know, game the system here?
I think the danger, though, is that we just wind up with permanent select committee on all the committees for the rest of time, forever and ever. Amen. And there's a kind of, you know, there begins to be a sort of fractal nature to committees, where each committee has smaller committees within it and also larger committees investigating it at all times everywhere, that can surely not be our best outcome from a policy perspective or perspective.
Unless it leads to one of those like Singapore Parliament chair smashing fights.
Which I would love to see. I actually, a true story, in my advanced placement government class in high school, we watched a video that my teacher had somehow obtained, like rolled the TV in, put the VHS tape in there, of just the like baseline conduct of various parliaments around the world. And it did include some high quality chair smashing action, which really inspired me to become the libertarian I am today. Obviously the FISA court needs scrutiny. I think that this ass backward way of getting that scrutiny is extremely likely to fail on all fronts. And we should probably just confront that directly and meanwhile not investigate everything. Now, I like watching the watchers, right? I don't mean to say, oh, well, I'm sure it's fine, let's move on, because it's deeply not fine. But the politically inspired investigations of investigations do not yield information. They yield more confusion and rhetoric. Mm-hmm.
They yield additional investigations of the investigations
it's
of
investigations
those investigations.
All the way down.
And eventually you end up in some sort of like string theory type scenario where, like, you could never get to the last investigation.
I think,
right?
It's like a Terry Pratchett Discworld situation where, like, all the investigations are balanced on the back of an enormous investigation.
It's interesting to think about why would Trump, and assuming the other thing about the whole Barr appearance is people getting really high and mighty about how, you know, the attorney general is supposed to be the country's top cop, not the president's personal attorney. And it's like the entire history of the attorney general is that they're a total bag man for the president. So, you know, this suddenly we're redefining the expectations of the attorney general. But it is kind of interesting to ask, why would the Trump Justice Department actually be interested in keeping this story alive? And I'm, you know, because it would be a good time to just say, fuck it, like, you know, we're done with this. Let's move on to the next stupid controversy and milk that for a while.
Well,
and
don't
it's,
we have
to my mind, I think it's probably that, you know, Trump and the people around him feel very secure that this exonerates him in some profound way.
We also have one answer to that, which is noted in the Washington Post story about the latest developments about Barr using the word spy. Just a few paragraphs down, there's a little note that says, by the way, the president's reelection site, like his official campaign site, is selling T-shirts that depict Barack Obama lurking in thick green shrubbery with a set of spy glasses. So that's why.
Yeah.
Like the idea that Obama spied on Trump, therefore Trump 2020, seems like a non sequitur and is in fact absolutely core to the
campaign. I think it's
going to
connect with his
campaign.
Audience. You know,
yep.
It's going to connect with his audience. You can already
though,
see that.
Also, to be fair, though, the official presidential portrait of like Obama in a shrubbery really was asking for this.
Suderman, you live in D.C. Is there at long last I think at long last is the Matt Bingo of vocabulary here.
No, it's Fantasia.
Okay. Is there a Fantasia that says, is there an argument that people can make, should make, are making, that, hey, messy as this all is, the system worked?
Well, sure.
Dangling the system worked bait in front of Suderman is like a cruel genius move.
The system worked.
Thank you.
is in some ways, it's in some ways true. It's also a bit of a dodge in that it doesn't, it sort of refuses to ask the question of whether the system is good and whether it should be like the way that it is. And so, sure, you can say that, that we have not seen a total breakdown in America's governmental institutions. Like, it basically, you know, Congress is still meeting, and occasionally they vote on some stuff. The president still does his thing. The executive branch is relatively populated by appointees, right? Like, things are still more or less trucking along as they're supposed to. And so in that sense, sure, of course the system worked. I think, you know, there's some, I would say that there's still some questions about what we're going to see from the final report. And in terms of how Barr is going to present that to the public and to Congress, there's, you know, what we're basically hearing is that there is an awful, that there is a, maybe not an awful lot, but there is a chance for a significant amount of redaction to the Mueller report. We don't know how much or how little at this point, and that neither Congress nor the public will ever see the unredacted report, or at least there are no plans for to show that at this time. And that gives Barr, who is in many ways, the, as you know, he's the, as Nick said, he's acting as a bagman for the president. He's acting as the president's kind of political defender. Gives Barr an awful lot of discretion to omit potentially embarrassing stuff that the president might not want out there. And that we don't know if the president or his advisors played any kind of direct role in this, because Barr has declined to say whether Trump and his team have seen the complete report or will. And so, you know, that's is that the system not working, or is that just the way the system is? Should we see the, you know, I think these are, should we see the whole thing? Should it all be made public? There was an awful lot of public money spent on this investigation. Should the results not be made available at least to members of Congress who are sort of relevant and interested? I think those are at least, I don't know if I know the answers to those questions, but I think they're worth raising.
Can we talk about the return of the phrase bagman? I feel like we've used it a lot of times on this podcast, but also that I'm seeing it just more in the world generally. Like, is there something about this administration that's inspiring people to bring back that
yes.
term?
I think so, because it's a mob term, and Trump talks like a mobster. I don't mean that as a good thing or a bad thing, but he does.
I just want to get like some pure Raymond Chandler the vocabulary back in there. Let's start talking about gats.
Yeah. Gats, gun souls. Punks.
I mean, like
getaway sticks.
Michael yeah. Cohen was about as
grab him by the getaway sticks.
A bagman, right? As you can, like he was a he passed off, you know, money to people that he was the guy who was sort of the pass through for payoffs that Trump was making to porn stars to keep their stories quiet, right? Like that's a bagman. That is like
that's
a bagman from a mob story.
By the way, I just did a Google Trends search to see if bagman is in fact on the rise, and it appears to have it spiked in maybe late August or September of 2018, thanks to a Rachel Maddow use. So just keep in mind that we are all standing on the shoulders of Rachel Maddow.
I wonder if Bag Lady is ever going to come back.
That's a whole different
other
thing.
But I'm just saying, you know.
Wow.
Can we,
you guys, know? That's my women's studies dissertation subject
we
right
don't
there.
Talk about,
why does Bag Man mean that and Bag Lady means that? Yeah. And what does it mean about the patriarchy?
That's the eternal question, as Mickey Rourke taught us. Let's
maybe if there's
another...
like a female version of Michael Cohen, we would call her like a bag ma'am.
Ma'am.
Yeah, that's not
oh
bad.
My
bag
god,
milf.
It's amazing.
There's a future at the either the New York Post or the Daily News, probably Daily News, if we're being honest. At you know, designing the wood over there, Suderman, for you. Another high profile case. Let's get to quickly before we have to skedaddle.
That's the big headline, guys. For people who are not in the journalism industry, the wood on a tabloid is just the big clever headline.
That sentence didn't make any sense to like 98% of our listeners, but okay.
Go see The Paper, one of the great journalism movies. It'll all become clear. Anyways, last week, high profile arrest, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks co-founder, terrible beard, pulled out of the Ecuadorian embassy after 7 years. possible.
Looking a lot like Saddam Hussein, really, with that beard.
Adam's, rat hole there. And Elizabeth Nolan Brown tweeted out that that was a good beard.
Yes. That is the most definitive evidence that we have had to date that Elizabeth Nolan Brown is a monster.
Yeah. My God, man.
She just likes beards.
She has distinctive taste.
Anyway, it's a bad beard, and he's making some weird moves, guys.
I saw some thing on Twitter a few moments ago, so it must be true, but that men's beards are passing around like more bacteria than in a dog's mouth.
No,
and this is kind of
Please stop. Please.
Must be Peter. Totally anyway,
Peter is caressing his beard at me right now, you guys.
Speaking of beard caressers, Nick, you wrote a
I wrote a secret memoir about a about beard stroking.
So there's a type of article that's called a chin stroker, right? So what is the beard caresser? Like, what subvariant of that article is that? It's just more ponderous.
I think it would be, and more disease ridden.
Would say ponderous. Yeah. Nick, you defended Assange from the get-go while everyone else was like standing up and cheering and high-fiving that this anti-American
Our fellow journalists were like, oh, finally.
Cult-inspired, you know? Pamela Anderson friend was being carted off. And you said Julian Assange is, we should cheer him. Why should we cheer this bad person, Easy? Easy's my daughter.
Wow. Wow, Matt. We're going to have
Matt,
to. You talk
are you having
about
another
that
stroke?
With your therapist
Lay
later.
Down.
Wow.
Good.
Why should we cheer this bad person, Nick?
So the main reason we should cheer WikiLeaks, you know, and Assange is an integral part of that, is because we now know, directly because of WikiLeaks, we now know a lot more about how our government has behaved. And it's all information that they wanted to keep secret because they behaved really poorly. And that includes things about, you know, war crimes or really bad screw-ups in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Cablegate stuff where they released thousands and thousands and thousands of diplomatic cables, which ironically, and that's one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton really hates Julian Assange and personally like dislikes him and vice versa. One of the odd things about that is that the United States government actually came out looking pretty well. Unlike a lot of foreign countries, our diplomats were kind of saying the same thing in private as in public. But WikiLeaks in 2010, especially, I mean, it started a few years before that, but it really changed the conversation about, you know, what I call forced transparency or radical transparency, where governments, corporations, a lot of other people are going to have to start making their private behavior commensurate with their public behavior. And I think to the extent that we're in this situation and we know worse things about our government than we do, it's because of WikiLeaks, and that's a net positive for us.
I actually have a question for Nick, and I really don't know the answer. This is not intended. This is not one of these where I think there's a clear answer. How would you feel if WikiLeaks today or last month or 6 months ago had released Donald Trump's tax returns?
I would have been excited to read it. I mean, to be honest, and I've actually been thinking more about, you know, one of the main arguments against the way WikiLeaks does stuff. And again, early on, they used to try to redact stuff and they would try to they said that privacy was a major issue and that they were not interested in undermining individual privacy. And then pretty quickly, when they realized how much work and time it took to strip out kind of extraneous details in these massive data dumps and stuff, they didn't do it. And they released a lot of, and at one point, actually, Assange had told an audience, like, you know, your personal dental records or medical records are of no interest to us, et cetera. And then a couple of years later, during one of their dumps, they actually released a bunch of private medical data that was part of a Saudi Arabian release of documents of people of no public interest or anything. That's troubling. There's no question about it. But again, on balance, I think we will, you know, privacy is a really fluid category. And I think nobody really is upset at the stuff that gets released that really is of no interest to anybody. And I'm not saying it's a good thing and it's mortifying and all of that, but on balance, what WikiLeaks has done has brought to the attention of the world a lot of information about it, a lot of really bad state actions that would not have come out otherwise. And so that's why I think it's good. And it would have been, it'd be great if they released Donald Trump's tax documents.
Peter, is the kind of bipartisan, lock up the beard kind of sentiment that you see out there to Assange, should we categorize this at least in part as overlapping with our moments now where we're looking for government to kind of trim the sails of online behavior and activity? Is that something to worry about, that this is a subset of a clampdown?
Yes, I actually think that's right. And, you know, I think it's definitely possible to quite dislike Julian Assange and what he did, and to even think of him as a bad actor. I'm not saying I do, but that seems to me like a totally even reasonable kind of feeling. And he is kind of sketchy, maintained clearly some pretty sketchy associations. At the same time, the legal actions against him are awfully close to the sorts of legal actions that could end up ensnaring journalists in traditional journalistic activities. EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has been very good on this and released a statement saying, saying that several parts of the indictment describe very common journalistic behavior, using cloud storage or knowingly receiving classified information or redacting identifying information about a source. Other parts make common free software tools like Linux and Jabber seem suspect. And while we are relieved that the government has not chosen to include publication-based charges today, the government can issue additional charges for at least another 2 months. And then they've gone to say it should not do so. And so, you know, there is an argument to be made that the legal action, the state action against Assange is effectively action against him for doing something that is very much like journalism, which is putting unknown information that in many cases people and especially governments don't want to be known into the public domain. And anything that that gets close to that is, I think, something we should be very worried about. And journalists in particular should not be cheering on.
Speaking of journalists cheering things on, we're going to go to our end of show What Are You Consuming thing a little bit early this time around. Not necessarily so that we can issue a bunch of Game of Thrones spoilers, which I predict are going to happen despite my warning that they shouldn't. But because one great journalist website person, Catherine Mangu Ward over here, is going to tell us about how Reason has migrated to a new design and things and stuff and people and why she killed the blog. Catherine.
Hi, Matt. I killed the blog.
What? That's the blog. This was generational warfare. This is you stabbing the olds in the ribs.
Yep.
Stabbing the 90s. People.
That's what I do every day. Stab the olds in the ribs. Yeah. No. So this is, despite having been made from an old's rib, I think, biblically. yes, we relaunched Reason.com. It's so beautiful, you guys. It should also work better. The old design, bless it, had some vintage attributes that it was time to shed. And the main change is that there is no longer a hit and run blog. There are still all of the great stories that you would have read at the Hit and Run blog. They just exist as standalone articles now. You can read them on our main page. You can read them in the handy dandy verticals. Also exciting about the new website, it's much easier for people to find this podcast.
Oh, hey, that's cool.
I think it looks great. And if people even miss the blog, that won't, you know, by 5:05 p.m. today, people will have forgotten.
Yeah, where the blog used to be, there's a thing called Latest, which basically spools out our content in reverse chronological order, just like a blog. It's just that you don't read the, you know, opening three paragraphs of, Nick talking about Zager and Evans or Robbie talking about cultural appropriation.
You have to scroll down to get to the Zardoz reference.
Yeah, we tried to keep Zardoz below the fold wherever possible.
That's
on the new
only,
website. It's a family
it's horizontal.
Website.
It's the main
it's
design
horizontal.
Principle.
Yes, I was like Justin Marr, our new web designer,
who has done so much incredible.
Who
work.
Is incredible? Can we talk real quick, actually, about Justin Marr? I know that nobody cares, but I just got to say,
you're the boss.
Wow, that nobody cares. Nobody.
Nobody cares on this podcast. However, he is a miraculous human who is a web developer who speaks normal human English, And I just want to give a shout out because he might be the only one.
Thank you, Justin. All right, Peter. With spoilers in mind,
there are going to be spoilers. If you're listening to this podcast, get out now if you don't want Game of Thrones spoilers.
Thrame of Gones, tell us.
It was good. It was a full hour of like people riding on dragons and talking about who's going to be king and why. And like, that's why we watch this show. It was, one of the things that struck me, right, is like this show is hugely popular. I went to Trader Joe's in Washington a few hours before the show, and like, it's packed on Sunday afternoon, and I overheard multiple conversations. Right. It's Sunday afternoon at like 4 o'clock. And like everybody in Washington, D.C. at Trader Joe's is talking about Game of Thrones. It's like the Super Bowl. Right. Like it's just sort of it's become this sort of huge cultural thing. And for a mass culture product, it's really a surprisingly good show. Right. Like often those sorts of mass culture products, they can be good. They can be fun. But they're not good in the way that Game of Thrones is good, or very few of them are. And so, I am appreciative of that. I'm glad the show's back. I think, as we were talking about on the special edition podcast that Catherine and Robbie Suave and I did last week, I think the show was really kind of vindicating the Robbie theory that Daenerys is going to turn out to be a villain, and that Sansa is going to end up in maybe not being a ruler of all Westeros, but in a position of large scale power at somehow or another. I think there were some complaints about one of the show's big effects sequences in which Daenerys teaches Jon Snow to ride a dragon. Of course, Jon Snow we now know is a Targaryen, which means that he can ride a dragon. Basically, that's what it means. And it's like this sort of pointless sequence in which they're just like, yay, we're flying dragons through canyons. We're cute. We have a big effects budget. That sequence is very clearly setting up what I have expected to be if not the climactic moment for a couple of years now, which is Jon and Daenerys each riding a dragon. Dragon fighting each other, and people were like, "Oh, that's
is that what the kids are
sort of
calling
pointless.
It these
yes,
days."
Dragon fighting each other, and that's what's going to happen. And honestly, like, I think the show, Chris Orr of The Atlantic wrote a very good piece about the decline of the show's plotting as it has grown away from the George R. R. Martin, the original story that he wrote. At the same time, the show has become a pretty fascinating exercise in cinematic television making, in making a TV series that is as big and lavish looking as a huge budget movie. These final six episodes cost something like $100 million. And I think it's pretty telling that there was an HBO exec who, when he first saw the draft cuts of these final six episodes, the statement he gave to the press was that it's like they made six movies, and that's what they're going for. And I think in a lot of ways, this first episode set up five more pretty fascinating swords and dragons and kings and queens movies.
I just want to give a very brief shout out to my carefully constructed digital bubble that I live in, because Friday afternoon at 4:30, every single thing on all my devices was like, hey, Game of Thrones, guys, in a way that was actually really delightful. Like, my push news alerts came up and were like, Game of Thrones, let's talk about it. Here's some stories from your favorite websites about Game of Thrones. And my email was HBO saying like, hey, did you mean to resubscribe to HBO? Because you canceled it, after the last Game of Thrones. Here you go. Here's a handy link where you could subscribe it. My Twitter feed was like, oh, here's your little Game of Thrones hashtag with the custom emoji. Bet you want to chat about it with your friends. It was just like actually, it was the upsides of zero privacy, which we have talked about here before. It's true that the internet knows everything about me, but oh, the bounty it gives me in return.
But the thing they know about you is that you really want to watch Game of Thrones. I want to just say one more thing, which is that you're sort of going back to this notion of people talking about it at Trader Joe's and right, sort of being an item of cultural conversation, the way it has taken over a huge amount of kind of pop culture conversation, the way it comes into all of our feeds. It is the ultimate vindication, I think, of HBO's strategy begun that was begun in the late 1990s when they started really investing in original programming, kind of kicked off the, what we now are have talked about as the golden era, golden age of television with The Sopranos and The Wire and Deadwood and shows like that, although it started a little earlier with shows like Oz and Sex and the City. And at the time, I forget the name of the HBO exec, but the I believe it was the director of original programming said, look, I don't care about ratings. I don't want to do what the networks are doing. Instead, what I want to do is I want to create shows that will be written about on the op-ed page of the New York Times. He aimed to create products of sort of elite, upper middle brow cultural conversation. And like no show has done that better, really, than Game of Thrones. And it's you kind of wonder if there will be another one, or if Game of Thrones is kind
stop.
Of
stop. Don't get declinist about it just
no,
yet.
No, I'm not
Peter.
Saying that it's declinist. I'm just saying that it's a show that has brought people together in a way that the kind of the fragmentation of the of TV and movies and sort of the storytelling universe means that it's hard to, you know, it's not impossible, but I think it would be difficult to recreate this sort of thing.
No, and I agree. I mean, it's, you know, there's something like that about the, you know, the young adult form after Harry Potter closed out and whatnot. Will we see this again? I think to your broader point, one of the things that I find really fascinating, this is, I think you're right about Game of Thrones as kind of like a real summit of achievement from an HBO model. But more broadly, if in our politics, the future hasn't really arrived, like, you know, what's going to work? It's just not working. And, you know, we're stuck in stuff that Matt and I have written about for years of, you know, failing identification. I'm hesitating to say the Declaration of Independence, but it's like in our politics, we're seeing the old order is dead, but it's not quite been brushed away yet. In our cultural lives, and especially in things like, HBO or Amazon Studios and Netflix, a wide variety of music services and ways of just producing and releasing and distributing content, we're there, and it's pretty freaking great. And it's, you know, it's frustrating that we can't seem to kind of have that come over, even in our commercial and other parts of our economic lives. Like, it's clear that the kind of models of jobs that we grew up with, those are not going to probably live to the end of our work lives, much less our kids and grandkids. But in the cultural arena here, we're seeing these incredible products that really tap into what people want to talk about and create a space where, you know, it's the best form of culture where you're not just watching something, but it becomes the pretext for a million different conversations in all different ways. And it's really, it's very exciting from a large structural change that this is a place where the 21st century is alive and well.
Shout out to my own bubble of existence. I was not near a single conversation about Game of Thrones over the long weekend. And the only thing I saw a reference to it was a local bar, which I put up my Instagram feed, which said, Game of Thrones is stupid, get drunk instead. Sign out in front, which I thought was great. Nick, what have you been consuming?
Most recently, I'm reading Ian Bremmer's 2018 book, Us Versus Them, which is a discussion about globalization and nationalism and why that is one of the major battlegrounds that we're facing now. Bremmer is the head of a thing called the Eurasia Group, and they do kind of investing and trend spotting and whatnot. He has a PBS show on Saturdays or Sundays as well. Really interesting thinker, really original. And, this question of, in a world where capitalism, global capitalism has brought a lot of wealth to a lot of people, particularly in the developing world, what is the backlash to that? And one of the things that's most interesting to it is that the backlash, of course, is coming from the old world, which includes the United States now, North America, Western Europe, Central Europe, not from the developing world as much. So it's, you know, how do we sell globalism back to the people who started it, 50 years ago? That's kind of an interesting question to think about.
Breaking news here at noon on Monday, Chris Jansing, MSNBC, great Chris Jansing, love her. Mueller report to be released both to Congress and the public Thursday morning.
I'll believe it when I see it.
Get ready for all of that. My report here, speaking of dragon fighting, I think that was one of the
euphemisms for masturbation that I saw Chris Elliott give to
Lord
give to Ben Stiller in rewatching There's Something About Mary on the airplane ride the other day. The movie's still totally holding up and still totally impossible to imagine.
How are Matt Dillon's teeth in that?
Oh my God. Oh my God. It's phenomenal. I saw three movies on my trip back and forth to California. I will rank them in order of how much I cried. I probably cried the least at Something About Mary, but just a little bit. I cried more at a movie I'd never seen before, The Dark Knight. It's a good movie. People were right about that.
Tell us about Casablanca next, Matt.
I saw that for the first time like 5 years ago. It's pretty good,
Rosebud.
Too. The one that I'd like to talk about,
pretty
sure someone had, you son of a bitch.
Spoilers!
Someone had probably mentioned here before, and, you know, obviously saw it in the absolute wrong context, but probably better for my own sense of dread, was Free Solo, which really hit me like a ton of bricks.
Matt, why did you watch that? That's not a good movie for you to watch.
It's also
especially not a movie
to watch on an airplane when you are hanging in the sky 5 miles above the ground.
If I saw that in IMAX, I would have dissolved in a pool of my own bodily fluids. There's just no way that was going to work out for me on 1,000 different levels. So that was as safe as I could consume it. But what a wonderful and frightening meditation on like excellence and love and alienation, loneliness and filmmaking ethics and God knows what else.
Though to be clear, Matt, did you have the exact same reaction to 27 Dresses on airplanes?
Yes.
Like that's how you feel about all movies that you watch on airplanes. Just so that listeners can appropriately handicap your reviews here.
Yeah, you know, but I think it gives you things to think about beyond just my own emotional vulnerability.
Matt, did you seen the, it's years old now, but when the Red Bull guy did the longest free fall into Earth's atmosphere? It's deeply moving in the same way that Free Solo is.
And you can watch it on YouTube in a way that is much less terrifying than either airplane viewings of a movie about hanging by your pinky from a rock a mile up.
There's a documentary, and it might be the same one, it might not, Nick, about a woman who does some of that kind of free falling with the wings thing that came out like 5-6 years ago. She was from Scandinavia somewhere. It's terrifying and a little bit less of a happy story than Free Solo. And I don't want to spoiler too much there, but, if people were interested in Free Solo, go out and try to find what I just described using search words, cause that's also pretty good. And I think that's all the time we have to search words here on the Reason podcast. Thank you all for listening. Get ready for Mueller Report Madness on Thursday, if it happens. And if it doesn't, send your hate letters to Chris Jansing. Certainly write reviews and ratings and things like that in the places that you find us. And enjoy the new damn website. Send your I missed the blog letters directly to Catherine.
Or don't.
or don't. I presume that there won't be any, as Nick said. But thank you for listening, and see you next week. And goodbye.